The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's really astonishing that there's not been a broader government effort to get to the bottom of what threat these pose to Americans.
I'm Serafine Danani, legal fellow of Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 19th, 2023. In the wake of September 11th, 2001, federal law enforcement agencies were caught flat-footed when they realized that they'd had the intel to prevent the attack on the homeland, but they failed to connect those dots. Fusion centers were born out of an abundance of caution to share and streamline counterterrorism information between the federal level and state and local levels. Since then, the Department of Homeland Security has supported the development of a national network of 80 fusion centers across the United States. And while its principal goal initially was to disseminate counterterrorism intel from the state and local levels, it's now expanded to include the sharing of intelligence regarding crimes or hazards more broadly. Last month, the Brennan Center released a report entitled Ending Fusion Center Abuses, explaining how Fusion Center's domestic intelligence model has undermined Americans' privacy, civil rights, and civil liberties. I sat down with Michael German, a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, who co-authored the report, as well as Thomas Warwick, a non-resident senior fellow at the Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security Forward Defense Practice at the Atlantic Council. Both Mike and Tom individually spent over a decade working in federal law enforcement agencies. Mike served as an FBI special agent for 16 years, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. And Tom worked at the Department of Homeland Security for 12 years, most notably as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Counterterrorism Policy. They discussed how fusion centers were conceived, where they've excelled as intelligence centers, and where they've abused their powers. It's the Lawfare Podcast, January 19th, lifting the veil on fusion centers.
So I have to be honest here and begin by acknowledging that I hadn't heard about fusion centers until I watched your segment, Mike, on the PBS NewsHour. Mike, I'll begin with you. Can you explain to us what are fusion centers, you know, including their inception story, and what are they trying to achieve here?
I'll try not to feel a blow to the efficacy of my advocacy because I started writing about fusion centers in 2007. I had just left the FBI in 2004 and went to work at the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, where I was working on national security policies, and saw a bill that was providing $300 million to aid in the development of a national network of intelligence fusion centers. And I had never heard of this concept, and I was only 3 years out of federal law enforcement. So it alarmed me that this network of domestic intelligence hubs was being built across the country with very little public discussion. We produced a report that highlighted a number of issues with the way that fusion centers were being developed. One of the big problems is who is actually in control of these institutions, because they're set up as state, local, and regional entities, but they receive significant federal funding, but also access to federal counterterrorism and intelligence networks and databases. They also house FBI and Department of Homeland Security analysts and law enforcement officers. They include not just law enforcement, but other government personnel from state and local agencies, particularly emergency response and public health. And they also include the National Guard oftentimes. So they have some access to military intelligence. And they include private sector entities that are poorly defined in the guidelines that the federal government has produced and basically seems up to whoever is managing that a particular fusion center, what companies or private entities might get incorporated into fusion center operations and receive fusion center reports. So domestic intelligence collection has long been a politically fraught activity that often results in abuses. So the idea of establishing these very lightly regulated institutions in every neighborhood across the United States has raised significant concerns. And unfortunately, those concerns have been borne out through many examples of civil rights and privacy violations, as well as security vulnerabilities.
Thanks, Mike. Tom, did you want to add anything?
So I come at this from obviously a different perspective. I was a lawyer by training and experience, served in the State Department for 10 years, and then moved over to the Department of Homeland Security from 2007 until June of 2019, when I joined the Atlantic Council. And so at DHS, I was the senior career official on counterterrorism policy at DHS headquarters. Title was Deputy Assistant Secretary during that time period. So we actually relied on the work of fusion centers to help keep Americans safe. And while Mike makes a number of really valid and important points in his excellent report, folks should appreciate that fusion centers, by and large, reflect the communities that operate them. They are, as Mike said, actually run by state and local law enforcement. And most of their personnel are from state and local law enforcement who've been seconded there to try to fill a gap that was created, or at least appreciated, after the September 11 terrorist attack in New York City and against the Pentagon. What many people came away with from the 9/11 Commission's report was a very accurate sense that the dots had not been connected, and that it was therefore important for the country as a whole to do a much better job of understanding the terrorist threat, understanding terrorist networks and how they worked, and do a better job of bringing them to the attention of investigators, whether it's the FBI at the federal level or state and local law enforcement, to try to have these networks disrupted before they could carry out terrorist attacks. But that was right after 9/11. Since then, fusion centers have changed somewhat in their function. They still have counterterrorism analysis responsibilities. But in much of the country, the greater threat right now is from networks importing drugs into the United States, other kinds of criminal organizations rather than just terrorists. And the fusion centers have found themselves useful. I have to say, as Mike accurately says in his report, they're not panaceas. They're not magic cures. They're not, you know, what you see on you know, some of the police procedural shows like NCIS. They tend to be much more like a number of people in cube farms sitting looking at computer screens trying to make sense of a very complicated picture of threats against a state or locality. And these are really local and in some cases national and other police and the people who support them trying to make sense of what are the threats to our community. There have been some problems, many of which Mike identifies, and the real challenge is in solving those problems. But the fusion centers serve a useful purpose. We do, however, need to make sure they have proper oversight, proper funding, that they're clear on what their mission is, and that we really do see them as taking advantage of the ability to connect the dots so that we can make our country safe and secure.
So let me tease that out a little bit. Their mission. What is their mission? Or do they share a mission? Because I know there are several dozens of them in the United States. Are they all working collectively under one mission, or does each fusion center have its own objective?
So there are about 50 of them across the country. Many of them are run at the state level, but in some cases, especially where you have large cities, they tend to be run by a city or sort of regional outfit. The place where you think there would be a fusion center, New York City, actually, the New York City Police Department runs something that's not a fusion center, but that serves the same purpose of bringing different professions and specialties under one roof for the purpose of you know, combining what people know to try to understand terrorist threats. And New York City has had a number of terrorist attacks that have been successful, nothing on the scale of 9/11, and the fusion centers have actually helped make that possible. But at the same time, the goal of these centers is to prevent terrorism and crime as much as it is to try to you know, play detective in solving crimes that have already occurred.
And I would just add that the breadth of the missions that these centers claim is part of the problem. When the federal government was investing in these fusion centers, they were promoting them as counterterrorism intelligence networks, but were having difficulty getting buy-in from the states because they oftentimes didn't feel that terrorism justified the investment of resources from the state and regional level. So they moved to an all-crimes mission statement, and then eventually to attract non-law enforcement entity, what they call all hazards. And as I said, domestic intelligence is problematic in a democratic country writ large, no matter who's doing it. But when you establish an entity whose mission is so broad and put it in a network where there are 80 of these centers across the country, approximately, the numbers change over time, and each of them claiming a different mission of different breadths, all connected to the same network, results in a lot of information being collected and disseminated that really law enforcement has no business obtaining. And the privacy of American citizens engaging in activities that don't raise any suspicion of criminal activity are being collected and disseminated throughout the country. And again, because of the breadth of the mission and the diversity of personnel being invited to participate in these operations, you often have information being collected straight off the cesspools of social media and being disseminated through this network as threat warnings, that there's no regulator to remove misinformation or disinformation that's being spread through the system. So the network becomes polluted with bad information that isn't helpful to anyone, and information that violates the privacy and civil rights of individuals who are the targets of these collection efforts.
So, Seraphine, let me take January 6th as an example.
Sure.
This is a case that we know a great deal about because there has been an enormous amount of work done after the fact to understand what went wrong and what was the set of failures that allowed this attack to proceed without the Capitol Police being ready for it. The agencies involved have conducted after-action reviews. Journalists have done a great job at bringing to the fore a lot of the facts that you know were not known by everybody at the time. A number of think tanks and nonprofits, including, I have to say, the Atlantic Council, where I work, have done an enormous amount of work trying to understand the nature of what the threat was on January 6th and who knew about it. This is a classic example where the dots were out there. The information was on social media in both public postings and in private fora that should have made it very clear that there was the likelihood of violence at the Capitol on January 6th in an effort to stop Congress from the lawful counting of the electoral votes. And, you know, the challenge that we had had on September 11, 2001, and on January 6, 2021, was in putting together the picture in a way that would allow those whose responsibility it was to protect, in this case, the U.S. Capitol, to marshal the necessary resources to prevent the attack. In this case, there was an ample body of information on social media. There was an ample body of information, additionally, from confidential sources that law enforcement had. And what was not happening was to have all this information come together in a way that was sufficient to compel the people who could have stopped this, in this case, primarily the U.S. Capitol Police, from marshaling the resources that would have allowed them to do that. In theory, obviously it didn't work on January 6th, in theory, that's the kind of role that a fusion center ought to play. That does require an awareness of social media. It does require following proper constitutional procedures that are put in place to protect privacy, civil rights, and civil liberties. And so, for example, that law enforcement does not have the authority to penetrate telephone communications unless it goes and obtains a warrant under established procedures. There are a whole host of measures that are in place. And then the question is, what is done with this information? What you would like to have seen in order to have prevented the attack on the U.S. Capitol was for the right people in the right place to make the connections, reach the conclusion of what was going to happen if protesters reached the Capitol, and then the Capitol Police should have been there in sufficient presence to deny them entry into the building. It's, you know, one of those kinds of intelligence failures, like 9/11, that gets analyzed in extraordinary detail. The kinds of crimes and incidents that most fusion centers have to deal with never rise to the level of the assault on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. But the question is how we balance as a society the kinds of tools and resources and information that we want law enforcement to have against the very valid privacy, civil rights, and civil liberties concerns that people ought to be protected, especially for everything that falls below the threshold of violence. And that turns out to be the line that needs to be watched the most closely. Acts of violence are illegal. Free speech is constitutionally protected. There's a tiny gray area in between, and that's certainly worth talking about. But there's a clear distinction that law enforcement draws, whether you're talking about fusion centers or otherwise, between acts of violence that are the subject of investigations, arrests, and prosecutions, and constitutionally protected speech. And most of the time, that's the distinction that everyone in law enforcement ought to be following on, you know, cops on the beat, fusion centers, the FBI, DHS, state and local governments. That really needs to be the basis of everything from our training to our practice.
And to that point, Tom, I think that's fair. This line drawing exercise between what is going to look like a First Amendment protest and we can leave that alone versus, you know, this probably will lead to violence and we should keep an eye on it. And I'm wondering, I understand that fusion centers seem to be quite stratified. They're not under one mission, but what are the factors that they're considering when drawing this line between, you know, this is First Amendment protected and this is probably going to lead to violence? So, for example, we have the reasonable suspicion standard that law enforcement must meet before they can collect and maintain information on individuals. You know, is that the standard that fusion centers are using as well when they're collecting and disseminating their intelligence reports to higher ups? Why don't we go to you, Mike, for that?
Thanks for this question. And I think what January 6th highlights is the failure of the intelligence model that was created after 9/11 with this concept of balancing privacy and civil liberties against security. My experience as an FBI agent, particularly working undercover in domestic terrorism investigations, convinces me that this is a flawed model. And I think January 6th proves it, where, it, as Thomas had said initially when talking about 9/11 and the conceptual creation of fusion centers, this idea that the problem was not connecting the dots. And what the fusion centers and much of the intelligence that DHS and the FBI have engaged in by reducing the threshold for collection. So you mentioned the reasonable suspicion requirement that had long been part of law enforcement criminal intelligence regulations and also the FBI's internal guidelines were diluted significantly. And what that created was the collection of lots more dots. And the problem was never a lack of dots, right? The 9/11 Commission report makes very clear over more than 400 pages that the FBI, CIA, and NSA had a tremendous amount of intelligence forewarning of the plot. It was that the proper policymakers chose not to pay attention to those dots. And what the Senate investigation of 9/11 said is because those important pieces of information were lost in the vast streams of intelligence being collected through the foreign intelligence networks. So those vast streams have turned into raging rivers and vast oceans of data that is now being collected by these agencies and reported through these networks, so much that nobody can process all this information that's coming in. Worse, because the training and capabilities of individual fusion centers across the country is so lax, what's being put into this system is often nonsense. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can look at information that's been obtained through Freedom of Information Act requests, but more often through leaks, where just recently in 2020, there was a massive leak of gigabytes of law enforcement data going back 20 years. They included a lot of these fusion center reports caused by a security vulnerability in a contractor. And again, it shows not just that the data that was released shows that a lot of the information that these fusion centers were producing was misinformation, disinformation, information that was promoting spurious threats that was about what the far left organizations and protest groups were doing that was coming from far right websites, but then stamped with a fusion center logo and passed into the intelligence network. So all this information is basically making it harder for policymakers to understand what's really going on and distracting them from real threats. So what we saw during the Black Lives Matter riots was a tremendous amount of fusion center reporting on spurious threats being reported, that Antifa was starting wildfires in the West, that Antifa was planning a vehicle-borne explosive device against National Guard people in Minnesota. It just stuff that was clearly not based on reliable evidence, and that was misdirecting law enforcement resources. And you know, coming to January 6th, you know, we have a lot of self-serving reporting after the fact that fusion centers had been warning about far-right violence at the Capitol on January 6th. And I'm sure some of that is true, but again, whether that was just amidst a lot of reporting about groups that weren't involved in that violence is the broader question. But part of the reason I think policymakers didn't pay attention to it is because they had become inured to not paying attention to fusion center reports because they were so often either something that wasn't accurate or wasn't helpful. And that's the key point that after 9/11, there was this concept that more intelligence was better. But if that intelligence is untimely, if it's erroneous, if it's collected from untrustworthy sources, it isn't trusted by the policymakers that are supposed to act based on it. So it's a flawed methodology that has proven, again, through these leaks, to produce an awful lot of privacy and civil rights violations, and not significant evidence that it does anything to achieve its counterterrorism purpose, much less its criminal justice purpose. I mean, one of the things that coming out of law enforcement and seeing these changes, I assumed that the creation of these intelligence networks would help in finding and solving more crime just by accident, that they're going out to look for terrorists and serious criminals, but because they're collecting so much information, it's easier to solve other crimes. But in fact, we've seen crime clearance rates go down over the last 20 years, and particularly in serious crimes like murder, where the clearance rate is just over 50%. So half the murders in the country continue to go unsolved, even as we've built this national network of intelligence centers that don't show demonstrated efficacy in assisting in crime investigations. And it just relies on anecdotal stories from people in the network saying, yeah, we find it helpful. Well, that's not really how it works. We've created a situation where we've built this network that collects information about American citizens in their own communities and compiles it. So it's one-stop shopping for hostile actors who want to use that information for bad purposes. So if hacktivists were able to get this type of information, I think it's silly to assume that hostile foreign nations aren't also getting it. And it's really astonishing that there's not been a broader government effort to get to the bottom of what threat these pose to Americans.
Well, and of course, Serafine, the irony is almost all of this information is in the hands of the private sector and comes from, you know, social media and other companies that people provide this information to voluntarily. Any data repository then becomes obviously a target of interest to foreign actors. And, you know, we need to look to private companies as well as to the government to do a better job of protecting our personal information.
Tom, I do want to stay there for a second, because I acknowledge that is troubling. And even taking it a step back for a second, why are we mixing private companies into the fusion center ecosystem? What value do they add?
Yeah, that actually is a mistaken perspective. I think people may come away from Mike's report with a mistaken understanding of what role these companies serve. There are two different things going on, or at least two. Actually, there are more than that. The first is that when mall operators or sporting venues or other private groups organize public events that have a security concern or nexus. I mean, the classic example being the Super Bowl, where the NFL has, an extremely active security component to it to make sure that people are protected when they're at games. You know, the state and local government, as well as federal authorities, often liaise with these private entities to try to help protect their venues. And one of the examples in Mike's report was, an oil pipeline that had been, I'm sorry, it may have been a gas pipeline, but a pipeline that was perceived that it had been targeted by people, goes to the fusion center and to the state and local law enforcement agencies and say, help us understand what's necessary to protect our pipeline. And then you get a question, and this is independent of fusion centers, by the way. The state and local law enforcement authorities have the kind of dilemma that Mike describes every time, when they have to decide, what do you tell a private operator about the threat to his or its property? So that's a classic dilemma that law enforcement has. There's a separate matter in that a lot of these fusion centers, like other parts of the government, state, local, federal, employ private companies to support them in their mission. And this ranges from everything from the people who maintain the computer systems. I suppose you could include the caterers, but that gets out to one extreme. But oftentimes they do employ companies to help them analyze data. And in that case, the companies are supposed to be operating under the supervision and control of the law enforcement authority. They are supposed to never have more authority than the law enforcement agency itself has and can only do the things that the law enforcement agency is permitted to do. There is a debate that has gone on for years about whether people who do these missions should be sworn officers of the organization or agency that employs them, and whether the whole idea of contractors is actually a good idea. At the Department of Homeland Security, the Congress quite rightly pushed DHS's Office of Intelligence and Analysis to replace many of its contractors with federal agents and officers, people who could be responsible under the codes of conduct and rules for handling sensitive and classified information that all federal employees are required to follow. And so the role of these contractors is supposed to be to provide a service that government is not able to provide for itself. But one of the things that I think is a positive change is getting people who perform essential government missions to be government employees rather than contractors, wherever that can you know, be done under the appropriate rules and regulations.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, Lawfare listeners. Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep
acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
And both contractors and employees of Fusion Centers, perhaps the ones that aren't coming from the law enforcement agencies, what are the backstops, if you will, to ensure that they don't have access to the counterterrorism databases of federal law enforcement agencies?
The way it actually works, most of the employees in Fusion Centers are state and local law enforcement people, or are performing what is in local law enforcement is considered intelligence. I put air quotes around intelligence. In other words, they're not, you know, gun-toting, field-hardened police officers. They're people who have been hired for their analytical abilities, and they'll stay often in that kind of career path for much of their careers. But the purpose of these individuals is to it's not to support policymakers the way Mike described it. There are people who do fill that role, and certainly it's possible for a report that's done in a Fusion Center to be of interest to policymakers. But most of what's done at Fusion Centers are to support investigators rather than policy officials. Especially at the federal level, there's a whole network of organizations and components, including the U.S. intelligence community, that provide support to federal policymakers. One of the things that was put in place when the Fusion Centers were set up was the role, especially of the Department of Homeland Security, to try to figure out how do you not give everyone in every, you know, city and town access to highly sensitive sources of intelligence, usually collected overseas. And so this entire process got developed whereby information at a top secret level can be downgraded to either secret or official use only, or even unclassified information. And this actually is what creates a number of the problems that Mark identified. So, for example, quite often a report that is hugely sensitive, you know, there's a terrorist plot to carry out an attack in a U.S. city, will be, you know, redacted, processed, downgraded in ways that protect sources and methods for how that information was collected, but try to convey the essential nugget of what the police department needs to know in order to try to disrupt the attack. So this is what is one of the most important functions that DHS's Office of Intelligence and Analysis is staffed to try to provide. They aren't perfect. There is, as you would expect, a considerable amount of friction intentionally built into the system. It leads to reports that sometimes people at the state and local level will wonder, why on earth did they tell me this? When in fact, what they're actually reading is a product that has had all of the sensitive parts of it removed, leaving things that you know, to some people look like, well, this is obvious. And I have to say, yes, I understand this is a challenge. The process is, as I say, intentionally built in to have a lot of back and forth for the purpose of protecting sensitive sources and methods. In many cases, the actual value I've found of this kind of reporting is that the people who read it can have assurance that the people who are writing it are telling them the truth. In other words, they may not get the whole story, but the essence of what they're being told is something that they ought to be paying attention to. And if the process of intelligence analysis and distribution makes its way down to the state and local level correctly, then in most cases, the police chief in the local town will say, okay, yeah, I got it. And then he can decide how to brief his individual officers before they go out on patrol as to whether there's something they really need to concern themselves with or not. But the odds are, as we have actually seen in a number of cases, whenever there's a really serious plot with really serious consequences, usually that's when the FBI comes in to take the lead on an investigation, and their agents have higher level security clearances, higher level access. And often, as you've seen on television, there's friction between federal and local law enforcement. In this case, the fiction mirrors an occasional reality. But overall, this process has been very effective in disrupting a number of terrorist plots and attacks over the years, only a few of which make their way into public knowledge. But the process has worked, admittedly, as Mike rightly says, with some serious flaws and failures that you would hope would lead to corrections in the process over time.
Did you want to respond, Mike?
Yeah, if we can go back to the private sector participation, because I think that is one of the major concerns. There's two kinds of private sector participation in fusion center operations. One is actual participation, and federal guidelines encourage state and local fusion centers to invite private sector participants, but they don't have very strong guidelines for how to vet those private participants or how to incorporate them into fusion center operations in an appropriate way. And then there are also recipients of fusion center reports. Some entities within your community might get regular reports from the fusion center highlighting threats. And who gets chosen to receive those reports and who doesn't is often a very politicized decision. And Brendan McQuaid in Maine has done investigations of that fusion center and found that, basically, big business was included on these lists and labor unions were not. I worked at the ACLU and now work at the Brennan Center and feel that these are very important American institutions, but they don't get invited to receive this threat information. So it creates a two-tiered society, and that becomes problematic when you talk about the higher level participation, because the Oregon Fusion Center actually worked directly with one of these pipeline companies in characterizing protests against the pipeline company as a national security threat to justify law enforcement activity against them. This happened also during the Standing Rock protests, where the pipeline companies hired private security companies that actually were unlicensed at the time, that engaged in a lot of provocative activities and was sharing information in the Fusion Center network that obviously is promoting a certain view of the activities, presenting it as highly threatening. I remember one suggested because somebody in the encampment of protesters had a Palestinian flag, that was an indicator that Al-Qaeda or other foreign terrorist groups were involved in the protest. So this kind of sensationalized threat reporting that benefits the companies that participate in Fusion Center, it really risks equal application of justice throughout our criminal justice system. Part of the problem of who gets invited in is that there are these ambiguous lines of authority. You know, one of the things that's frustrating about fusion centers is they're very different. You know, in Los Angeles, the fusion center is actually located in FBI space and sometimes led by an FBI agent. So obviously their rules are going to be different from a fusion center that's run by some county organization that's not even law enforcement. And the network is only as strong as its weakest actor. And if there's one entity putting misinformation into the network, that will surely make the people who take this threat information look at it skeptically. And again, we don't have to talk in generalities. We have these leaked reports. So, you know, we have Fusion Center reports from Maine, for example, that warned that anti-fascists were stockpiling bricks near construction zones to throw at police officers. And when that leaked, the reporters sourced that to a white supremacist website who was putting out disinformation.
On that point about sourcing, how much of this is an issue with there just being a plethora of information out there and law enforcement, whether they be, you know, personnel in fusion centers or all the way up top at the DHS, are sifting through just too much versus like they themselves harboring some of these beliefs? Because I take your point, you know, it doesn't look good when during a Black Lives Matter protest, you're sending, as a fusion center employee, something to higher ups that's sourced from a white supremacist website. But giving some level of benefit of the doubt, it also seems to me to be an issue of literacy online, that we just need to train these employees to be better fact finders and be able to sift through social media better.
It's a huge problem. And you know, one of the problems with domestic intelligence collection over the last 100 plus years that this is an activity the government has sometimes tried to get involved in is that by its nature, it's highly politicized, right? If I'm not conducting an investigation like I did as an FBI agent, where I was looking for evidence of a crime and instead am trying to imagine what might be a problem in the future, my biases are going to color those perceptions dramatically. Right. Where if somebody is engaging in somewhat hostile activity, but they're promoting an idea I'm in favor of, I'm going to think, well, they're good people who are passionate about an issue of great concern. Where if somebody is promoting, say, police accountability, the law enforcement officer might naturally feel defensive about that and think that these people are a threat. And you know, then you look at the reporting that actually goes out, and like the FBI's Black Identity Extremism memo that identified protesters who were Black activists who were protesting police violence and racism as threats to law enforcement, that you can imagine how that gets amplified through this system, to the extent that when they see some wild statement online, it gets reported up as if it's accurate without any vetting. And, you know, to speak of the training, it's unclear if many of these contractor analysts and even law enforcement analysts get any training at all, much less who provides that training. You know, one of the things that we've seen is the nature of counterterrorism training, even organizations like the FBI and Department of Homeland Security and Department of Defense were putting out, was highly biased against Muslims and Arabs and produced a factually flawed analysis of what to look for. And one report suggested that a Muslim growing a beard was indicative of increased dangerousness. And likewise, shaving off their beard was indicative of increasing dangerousness. So, you know, identifying dressing in Muslim garb or praying more often were indicative of dangerousness. And this false information that was going out really applies because the fusion centers became the hubs for federal collection of what they called suspicious activity reports, which were basically the product created through the See Something, Say Something program, which the Department of Homeland Security still promotes. And, you know, the analogy I've tried to explain to law enforcement people is, you know, structure fires are a problem in the United States. You know, we do a lot to try to prevent them. We have building codes, we have, you know, fire alarms and smoke detectors, but we don't have a smell something, say something program, right? We don't have, is that smoke? Call the experts, because we know that false reports dull response. And that's why it's actually illegal to pull a fire alarm unless there's actually a fire in many places, because we know that the number of false reports will dull the response. And yet we have a See Something, Say Something program that the Fusion Center is participating in, collating these reports from local law enforcement and pushing them up to the federal government. One, for example, from Northern California was reporting that a Middle Eastern appearing male was buying a large quantity of water. Obviously, there's nothing suspicious about or counterterrorism related about buying large quantities of water. And the reason that whoever was reporting that saw it as suspicious was because the person had a Middle Eastern appearance. And yet these reports get sent up through the Fusion Centers into federal databases where the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force or other local law enforcement or Department of Homeland Security personnel actually go out and interview people. And they produce these kind of signs of what to look for that characterize things like photography or using binoculars or asking questions of a security person as inherently suspicious and related to terrorism. And of course, 99.9% of that activity is completely benign. But if you're reporting that kind of stuff constantly, it's easier to understand why on January 6th, federal law enforcement might have looked askance at some of this Fusion Center reporting.
Let me first actually clarify something, because a lot of what Mike has just described isn't really a problem with Fusion Centers. It's a problem with everybody who, you know, isn't either trained or well-led, who happens to find themselves working in a position of responsibility for trying to keep people safe. Fusion Centers, with one important qualification, and I'll get to that in a minute, because Mike has rightly put his finger on this as one of the crucial aspects of why we should consider Fusion Centers very seriously. The biggest challenge you have in leadership in an organization that's responsible for security is understanding what is legitimately and seriously a threat or a risk, and things that are innocuous and you know, not just constitutionally protected, but are you know, benign or indeed societally beneficial. A lot of what has happened, some of which Mike blames Fusion Centers for, but the problem that he's describing is actually different from that. You know, we have had problems with educating, you know, law enforcement officials and the general public to the nature of what motivates people to become criminals or terrorists, the incredibly varying reasons why people radicalize to violence. This is actually really tough. And it is absolutely correct, as Mike has pointed to, that there, especially after 9/11, was a considerable amount of anti-Muslim bias because people would see folks as contributing to violence who had absolutely nothing to do with it and were, in fact, totally peaceful. And especially around the protests after the murder by police of George Floyd in Minnesota in 2020, there was an enormous body that was frankly fueled by people who had malign intent to try to suggest that there were all of these conspiracies going on, when in fact, in most cases, these conspiracies existed in the eyes of the people who were advocating for this, not in reality. Where all of this came to a head is when the director of the FBI goes in front of congressional threat committees and gives what I consider to be an entirely accurate depiction that Antifa was not behind either the January 6th attack or a lot of other instances that folks had tried to say, well, this is the response, this is the result of Antifa. Well, no, it wasn't. And, you know, in fact, you can find in FBI testimony, in any number of well-researched, well-written reports, an accurate description of Antifa not being the conspiratorial source of enormous amounts of violence. That simply is not what the organization was, or even or to call it an organization is a misnomer. That's not what people who were using the self-identified term of Antifa were actually doing. You know, and this kind of thing goes all the way back to, you know, McCarthyism and the Red Scare and in the 1920s and a host of other movements where, you know, there may be a kernel of truth, but it's never more than that. It tends to then get blown up out of proportion to reality. And conservatives as well as progressives have complained about this in some cases with justification. Fusion centers are, again, with the one qualification I'll come to in a minute, are reflective of the society out of which they came, just like, you know, our other institutions are the reflection of the attitudes of the American citizens and everyone else who makes it up. The one qualification that is why it's worth giving thought to what are the responsibilities of fusion centers is actually what fusion implies. When you have a body of information that by itself an ordinary human simply would not be able to process, then a lot of things will fall like dust to the floor. The purpose of a fusion center is to bring together people to connect things whose connection might not be immediately apparent. And if a fusion center is run responsibly, that sort of thing will happen. And you will get the synergies. You will get people making connections to point to where drug networks are operating or, you know, in rare instances where there's an actual, you know, threat to security. It is, therefore, worth maintaining, you know, reviews and supervision of fusion centers to make sure that they follow the rules, and then separately to make sure that the rules are you know, responsibly written. And there will be tension and back and forth. People will chafe under rules. You will not always have these things be smooth. Part of the way these processes are set up is to try to gain the benefits of the ability of bringing people together to understand the real threat picture, but then to make sure that they follow the rules that are established and are in place. In the summer of 2020, things got out of hand. They got out of hand at DHS. They got out of hand in Portland. And there have been any number of reports that have sought to try to correct those excesses. And that's why, you know, reports like Mike are really required reading for people who want to try to understand how to make these things work better. But at the same time, I think, like everything else, and including like many of the reports that Mike was referring to, we've got to have a skeptical eye towards a lot of these things and to understand where any kind of report reflects the biases or prejudices of its authors. Critical reading is one of those skills that is absolutely essential for ordinary citizens, but especially for people in positions of responsibility over our law enforcement and security agencies.
In the spirit of trying to make fusion centers better, Mike, why don't we turn to you here? You divide up your recommendations into two buckets, reforms that you encourage the DHS to consider and reforms that you encourage Congress to consider. Can you explain a bit about what those reforms look like?
Sure. I agree with much of what Thomas said about how this is a bigger problem than just the fusion centers, and there should be robust rules to prohibit abuse and effective oversight to ensure abuse is discovered. And that's what doesn't exist in this system. So this report is part of a larger series of reports on reforming the Department of Homeland Security. since the Department of Homeland Security provides federal grants to these entities, provides access to Homeland Security networks and resources and places personnel in these fusion centers, they have a responsibility to ensure that the fusion centers are protecting the American public. And so we recommend that there is a much more aggressive oversight of fusion center activities by the Department of Homeland Security. And one particular issue that I just want to highlight because it was discussed is, you know, the problem that we pointed out in 2007 when I was at the ACLU was that the federal government was actually pushing the fusion centers to reduce the evidentiary thresholds for collecting and sharing information through this suspicious activity sharing requirement. You know, as Tom said, the period of McCarthyism, there was a police intelligence focused on red squads, going after perceived communists in their communities and people whose political aspirations the police department thought was harmful to society, rather than focusing on law enforcement. And the federal regulation that was put in place to prevent that was 28 Code of Federal Regulations Part 23, which required a police agency to have reasonable suspicion of criminal activity before placing information in a shared criminal intelligence system. But with the suspicious activity reporting program, they encouraged a lesser standard for collecting that information. And at the time, even some state and local police departments were having concerns, because the problem with the network of fusion centers is that the rules are different for every fusion center or every state. So it's hard to have a system that works in a network. And it's really the responsibility of the federal government to raise the standards, not reduce them. So reestablishing that reasonable suspicion requirement and ensuring that 28 CFR Part 23 is followed in practice and in spirit is crucial to limiting the opportunity for error and abuse in these systems. Further, we suggest Congress should create a special inspector general to conduct an investigation of fusion centers so that we have a baseline idea of what these centers do, because part of the problem with the fusion centers is the federal government gives them money and resources and then, you know, it says, well, these aren't the federal government, so they can do what they want. And that's not our responsibility, when local governments often don't have the capability of doing the oversight necessary to ensure these fusion centers aren't engaged in misconduct, much less that the fusion center across the jurisdictional boundary isn't collecting information about the citizens in their community improperly. So this special inspector general could go a long way towards identifying what are the problems with fusion centers and identifying if they can be reformed, how they can be reformed. And, you know, some states are already talking about closing their fusion centers. There was a bill in Maine that narrowly failed last year. And, you know, obviously, because these are state and local centers, it's the responsibility of elected representatives in those jurisdictions to determine whether these are necessary or helpful to state interests. But it's incumbent to give people who live in those communities information, to access to information about what the fusion centers are actually doing. And that's where we're extremely lacking here, where, you know, we have to rely on leaks, basically, and investigative reports rather than government oversight mechanisms. So establishing those government oversight mechanisms, including a permanent mechanism, I think is really important to make sure that these are operating for the public safety and not putting the public at risk.
Well, and Seraphine, here's the challenge, because some of what Mike is describing actually does exist. In other words, there are people at the Department of Homeland Security whose responsibility it is to watch over the fusion centers and to assess their performance. I got to tell you, having worked at DHS, the biggest challenge that INA has is it doesn't have enough of these people to do the kind of job that Mike is describing. Nobody does. The inspectors general are equally overtaxed without enough people to provide the proper investigation and oversight of other things that DHS and indeed other departments and agencies are doing. And this was one of the shortcomings that became manifest during the Trump administration. I think Mike would probably agree with me on that. The challenge is, just as we have been providing resources to state and local governments to set up these fusion centers and to encourage them through both financial support and other things to operate them, the tail, if you will, of what it takes to ensure proper oversight and supervision always struggles for funding. And, you know, I think one of the things that Mike's report usefully provides is an occasion to take stock of whether we have actually resourced the oversight mechanism for fusion centers at the right level. You know, Mike and I may disagree on whether as a whole fusion centers are worthwhile or not, but I think there's a way of having oversight without having micromanagement. And I got to tell you, having been there, the basics are in place. We've got to be able to make sure that we have people who have the resources to do the job that they're supposed to do, and then you know, to make sure that across the entire both national and homeland security enterprise, we have an understanding that it actually takes money and people to keep the country safe. We actually have an understanding in the military domain that there needs to be this kind of a balance, even if people may disagree on, you know, for example, how big the Navy should be or how many divisions we need to keep the country safe. We do not have anywhere near the necessary understanding of what it costs to keep the homeland safe from the kinds of threats that we now face. I'm not speaking of terrorism, although certainly the case can be made, you know, for domestic violent extremism work being underfunded. But across the homeland security enterprise, I think there needs to be an assessment of, you know, do we have the resources for the job that we expect our frontline officers to do for us to keep us safe?
On this point of reforms, I want to end with this question for both of you. So a couple of days ago, the House of Representatives created a subcommittee to basically investigate law enforcement biases against conservatives in the United States. What are your thoughts on how this might affect the way that law enforcement thinks about the reforms that the two of you just laid out? Because on the one hand, it seems like the representatives agree with your point, Mike, that the way that the law enforcement is collecting and disseminating information and intelligence is questionable, even unethical. But their concerns aren't motivated by protecting the civil liberties of minority groups or of activist groups on the left. Their concerns are that they want to protect the civil liberties of members of their own base. So is there a risk then that, you know, even down to fusion centers, we'll see employees give intel on far-right groups perhaps the benefit of the doubt, or maybe even turn a blind eye to the sorts of activities that some of these groups are perpetuating?
So anyone who would suggest that law enforcement is biased against conservatives hasn't spent a lot of time in any law enforcement office. Law enforcement is a very conservative profession that attracts very conservative-minded people. The institutions themselves tend to be very authoritarian, and even when somebody might not come to the organization with an authoritarian mindset, certainly that gets drilled into them. So this has been a longstanding problem of bias in law enforcement, targeting groups that are advocating for social change rather than groups that are engaged in violence. And I would point anyone interested in examining this to other reports I wrote regarding the FBI and response to far-right violence and the deficiencies in the FBI and DOJ's approach to it. But one highlight is that the FBI today doesn't know how many people white supremacists killed last year or the year before that or the year before that. You know, anytime somebody, a journalist talks about increases in white supremacist violence, I always ask them what data set they're looking at, because there is no official data set. And just a few months ago, the Senate Homeland Security Committee issued a report criticizing the FBI and Department of Homeland Security because they refused to collect domestic terrorism incident data. So they don't know how many domestic terrorist incidents occurred in the United States or who committed them. Likewise, the FBI said they could not produce prosecutive data from their domestic terrorism program. So my concern is that we would miss an opportunity to do objective analysis of what's wrong at the FBI and DHS and these other intelligence agencies and how they're harming the American public, rather than engage in partisan sniping on each side of the issue. You know, when I looked at the statements made by some of the FBI whistleblowers that are being highlighted by Representative Jim Jordan, who's apparently going to chair this committee, one of the things they talk about is how the lower standards for intelligence collection have allowed the FBI to target people with no evidence that they're posing a threat. And they're upset that that standard is being used to conduct intelligence investigations of conservative activists or others in the conservative political spectrum. And I have those same concerns. And you know, as long as we're looking at who else they're targeting with these lower standards, because it points to the obvious solution, which is raise those standards to the standards that the FBI worked under when I was there, that proved very effective in my own experience, being able to separate people who are engaged in speaking and writing and going to protests versus people who I had evidence were actually engaged in some kind of criminal activity or were planning it.
In almost all cases, law enforcement organizations recruit from their communities and therefore tend to pick up people with a range of views. It is true that opinion polls have shown that law enforcement tends to lean conservative, but it's not as extreme as some might think after what Mike has just said. That having been said, the thing that's most important, as in so many other cases, is good leadership, responsible leadership, training and education to make people, whether they're in law enforcement or any other similar function, really have the right level of understanding, knowledge, and instincts. You know, a good BS detector is one of the most valuable tools for any law enforcement official, or indeed for any citizen. I think this is why, you know, it was so disappointing that we couldn't come up with a much better approach on civics education that everyone could agree on. I'm not sure what to make of the plans for a congressional investigation. There is the sort of concern that when you look for something, you tend to find what you're looking for. I think what I believe is going to come out of the next several years is a heightened awareness on the part of American citizens generally that they need to take these issues much more seriously, and that it really is important as a country that we try to have a better understanding of what the real threats and challenges are, and that we not be distracted by, you know, the phantom menace, whatever it might be or wherever it might come from. You know, in some respects, the democratic process is a corrective to these things. It needs to be watched. It needs to be preserved. It needs to be nourished and cherished. And I think the election that we just went through shows that the American people can center themselves in ways that really do show what the strength of this country is. There are clearly problems. The problems need to be addressed squarely and honestly, but without blowing them out of proportion. And so I think it's really right that we look at all of our institutions and make sure that they are doing the job that we ask them to do. We can respect the courage and sacrifice it takes to keep our country safe and secure. honor the service of people who protect us at the state and local level, as we do in our military and elsewhere, and then make sure that they have the tools and the training and the leadership to do the job right, because I know that's what people are proud to see. And I really do think that's what the country is entitled to have.
Michael German and Thomas Warwick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sergeant.
And thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Mike.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get an ad-free version of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, Allies, and The Aftermath. Check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Pacha Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Noam Osbond of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.